Success is an emotional feeling that you give to the client that they did the best they could in the situation that they had.
Welcome to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. And now your hosts, Tim Cole and Jeff Lewis.
Welcome, everyone. I am Jeff Lewis.
And I'm Tim Kowal, operating under a probationary license from the California Department of Podcasting. In each episode of the California Appellate Law Podcast, we provide trial attorneys with legal analysis and practice tips from an appellate perspective. Both of us are appellate specialists who split our practices evenly between trial and appellate courts. We both work directly with trial attorneys to prepare cases for appeal. In this podcast, we offer some of that appellate perspective on various issues that arise in trial court and on appeal.
And welcome to episode 17 of the podcast.
And today we welcome Lee Goldberg to the show. Lee is an outside general counsel with over three decades of experience in corporate litigation and legal guidance. And I expect Lee will correct us and tell us exactly. He's got 34 or 37 or 62 years of experience. But I got to tell you, after three decades, Lee, we stopped counting. Lee writes and speaks about legal issues that affect business owners and their attorneys, including AB5. And I'll have the editor insert a boo sound effect there, and other employment-related matters. Lee's recent video series on LinkedIn and his website, callawyers.com, is about preparing a business for sale. I watched the series and found that it contains advice that I think every business attorney will find useful for their business clients. So thanks for being here, Lee, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, guys. Great to be here with you.
Now, if you would, I read off a little bit of a bio for you, but if you would tell our audience a little bit about yourself. And our audience is mostly trial attorneys, so please introduce yourself to our audience.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. I've been in practice, like you said, for 35 years. I'm outside general counsel to a number of companies across a very broad spectrum of industries. As general counsel, we handle everything, internal communications, internal structures, internal organization, internal operations. But then we also handle everything between the company and all third parties, including regulatory, including trade suppliers, trade contractors, and anything else that would affect the business, from financial to marketing to operations.
And Lee, I also noticed that you've been very active on LinkedIn over the past year or so. And I wonder if you would comment a little bit about that. I noticed that every post that you put up there on LinkedIn gets about a dozen at least comments from other attorneys. And I wonder how you do it. I wish I could get that kind of traffic. I probably need to stop being so esoteric in my posts.
Well, I got to tell you something. Number one, I love your posts because I learn so much. I mean, it's outside of my realm of operations. But with respect to my stuff, I will tell you flat out, I am a tech idiot. I don't know anything about technology. The only social media I have is LinkedIn. I did not have LinkedIn. I did not have a website. I did not have a YouTube site until my marketing guy, Gary Johnson, also a very dear friend, put that all together for me. And he's just done a wonderful job. I get a lot of good response from that.
Yeah, well, he's done a great job. And Gary promised me if we get his name in the podcast, he'd give me a free buy one, get one at Baskin Robbins. So, Gary, you owe me.
That sounds like Gary.
And Lee, before you became an outside general counsel, you used to be a litigator. Do I understand that right?
I was in a general practice. I did both transactional and litigation when my clients asked me for it. I never took a client just purely litigation. It was all handling a client. That experience has taught me that we should stick to what we're best at. And litigation was not what I'm best at. And I watch you guys in absolute awe.
Do you have any good war stories from your days when you were a litigator, or you know, most important lessons learned?
Oh, well, the most important lesson learned is, as outside general counsel, I'm going to hire professionals to come and get it done. That's first of all. Second of all, here's what I've really learned for me personally. I'm a business lawyer. I focus on business. I focus on getting it done. I don't focus on process. And process to me personally gets in my way. I cut through all the garbage and get to the end result, and I'll know right up front whether I'm going to get to an end result I want. In terms of litigation, it's a process that for me is completely frustrating. I completely don't understand some of the what I see as the form over substance and the expense created by the form over substance in order to get justice, if you will. I mean, at this point, guys, I look at the world of legal, transactional and litigation, what have you, as there's no such thing as justice. There's only dispute resolution. And you get the best dispute resolution people on your side. That's the way I look at it.
I think that's great advice. I still get a lot of clients, and I have to have that conversation with them about the difference between getting justice and just really, what do you want? And don't tell me, you know, to vindicate a principle or you want justice, because that's just the name on the side of the building. You know, that's not what is actually dispensed there.
Wow.
That's my cynical view.
Holy smokes, you two. What about the truth?
Yeah, well, truth dresses American way. I guess that belongs to Superman.
Well, that gets us, let us seg into the next subject I wanted to talk with you about. And most attorneys probably have a vague idea of what general counsel does and what it is. But my guess is that most of us attorneys don't really have a really good idea, an accurate idea of what a general counsel is or does. So in your experience, what have you gleaned? What do you think trial attorneys and litigators think that general counsel does versus the reality of what general counsel really does?
I get a lot of weird questions about what I do. I will tell you, most attorneys, whether they're transactional or litigation, unless they're specialized as general counsel, they really don't understand what it is we do every single day. And the best way I can explain it is we are a C-suite executive in the firm, in the company. We operate with all of the other operating and corporate officers to essentially effectuate all of their plans and organizations and operations for their business. We also sit and we handle the overview of all strategic planning for the business, both 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, and exit strategy planning years out. All right. And then third major category, which is how I'm involved with litigators, is we handle all or manage all dispute resolution. You can't operate a business these days without some dispute. You have to have the best guys around you. Now, if we can handle a dispute and resolution before it gets to litigation, that's certainly my preference. But if it gets to litigation, I choose litigators and bring litigators in that are specialized to handle those things. And that's what we do in every specific profession that helps a company. Is part of our job is to know the people that we can bring in to help, whether financial, accounting, sales, marketing, production, it doesn't matter. So knowing litigators and knowing good appellate lawyers for litigation is actually part of my job. It has to be.
Hey, I've got a question on a related note. As an appellate attorney, I'm interested to know, as general counsel, do you tend to favor the use of arbitration clauses, or do you use private judging or good old-fashioned superior court litigation?
That's really a great question, Jeff, because it's a very complex answer to what's seemingly a very simple question. Here's the deal. I hate arbitration provisions. Absolutely hate them. There's no appeal from them. And I had a situation about 20 years ago where we found after the arbitration an actual conflict of interest that was not disclosed by the arbitrator, that he had to disclose but did not disclose. We took that all the way to the California Supreme Court and lost because the Supreme Court said, well, you chose arbitration. Oh, well. Okay. I can't put my clients in that position at all. That being said, I favor alternative dispute resolution. A good mediator is worth his or her weight in gold. All right. It's a matter of positioning the dispute to get to that point. That's really where we're at.
Well, with that said, how do you view litigation as general counsel? Is it, we talked about, we're not out there to vindicate a principle or just to get justice. You're looking for a resolution. And I would think that most seasoned litigators would share that view. What do you bring to the table that helps focus litigators even more as general counsel?
Yeah, I use this quote all the time. It's from The Godfather. See, Sonny, it's just business. All right. That's the way I look at it. Litigation is a waste of money if you are not getting what you need. And you know what? The uncertainty of litigation is extremely costly on business. So the way I look at litigation is there's a dispute. We have some resolutions. We can get to resolutions if all sides are reasonable, because in my opinion, a reasonable settlement is where both sides are equally unhappy, right? You don't get what you want, everything. But as long as each person or each side is equally unhappy, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
They don't want to settle. They want to force my client into litigation. I have a completely different attitude. Scorched earth, baby. I will spend whatever I have to spend. I will do whatever I have to do. Winning is winning by attrition, running them into the ground. And if they force my client to go into litigation, into a trial, I'm telling you, we go all out. Win, period, at all. I'm like the old Raiders owner. Just win, baby. That's all that matters.
So it's not always the principle of justice, but sometimes it is a principle of respect. You know, you disrespect me, I'm going to run you into the ground. I'm going to signal to you that this is going to cost you if you're going to continue down this path.
Well, that's a really good point. I never thought about it as a respect thing. I think about it as a stupidity thing. You want to be that stupid? I'm going to show you how much it's going to cost. Your stupidity is going to cost you. It's not good for my client. My client is never principal over business, ever. Okay?
We got to
do business. And if it's going to cost me $400,000 to settle and $1 million to litigate, and my uncertainty about whether I'm winning or not is up in the air, I got to tell you something. We're sitting down to sit if we can get this resolved, move on, and make our money in what we make our money on. And businesses do not make their money in litigation, most of them.
Yeah. So is it maybe you could say that the objective oftentimes in litigation is you're thinking forward, how do I get to a judgment? But maybe from your perspective, a judgment is just another tool in the toolkit. If you can get to a judgment, you know, hopefully you would have found an off ramp before that point. But there are multiple ways of using getting leverage to get, you know, to get to an off ramp, to get to a settlement, some sort of resolution that makes most sense for the business.
Well, leverage is an important word to use there. That's what I use litigators for, is leverage. It's that simple. I've got to show them, the other side, that we're going to stand up at some point. But believe me, the idea is to show them how much it's going to cost them so we can come to the table and sit and talk like human beings and get a resolution.
I've always heard this story about how a general counsel choose litigation counsel. Maybe you can tell me if there's truth to it, that the general counsel will always favor hiring white shoe firms, because even if the white shoe firm loses, that can't come back and reflect badly on the general counsel, because they'll say, look, I hired the best money could buy. Don't blame me. Do you share that view?
I don't at all. Look, white shoe firms have their place. They're amazing, outstanding lawyers, and it'll cost you three times what you would be charged otherwise. You can get that. There are amazing lawyers out there. You have to go out there and get to know them as general counsel. You have to understand how they work. I have a whole bank of litigation firms of every level that I use for my clients, and understand some of it is matching the client with the right litigator, with the right disposition. Some of it is a litigator that has particular expertise in the challenges of that litigation. And all of it has to do with my relationship with the litigators and the litigation firm. Because I will tell you this, if I have a good relationship with them, then we coordinate and work together and understand, they understand where I'm coming from, I understand where they're coming from. And that best serves the client in the long run. So no, it's not always the Gibbs and Dunns, okay? It's not always the Reed Smiths that I bring into these deals, all right? Local, smaller, dedicated, smart counsel is what I look for.
Tell me about the relationship that you have kind of sitting in the middle of the client, the principal at your client business and dealing with trial counsel and appellate counsel. You're kind of sitting in the middle there. And what is it like with that relationship? Is the trial counsel communicating directly with the client, or are you the go-between? How does that work typically?
Well, it can work in all sorts of ways, certainly. Typically, what I like to do is, no matter where the communication lines are, I'm always involved in the communication. My clients, I will tell you, when there's direct communications, it only adds an extra step, because my client is going to come to me and say, what did he say? What do you mean by that? What's going on there? I do like the communication direct from me. Every one of my engagement agreements say specifically that the firms take direction from me, not from the client. Every one of them, I have very close relationships with clients, and I know most firms will, outside firms will not, when they bring in outside counsel, pay those outside counsel directly. I do that. I want that outside counsel to know that they answer to me, because I'm the one that looks over their shoulder and have to answer to my client for anything they do right or wrong. I mean, it sits with me.
So and you're the client's. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead.
And you're the client's the first line of defense on bills. Do you take on that role of looking at the bills and dealing with billing issues?
Absolutely. But also, I understand billing, and I understand attorneys have to make money. But I also understand my client needs value.
Yeah. And in terms of getting value, do you ever allow lawyers to work on either a fixed or a contingent fee as opposed to the traditional hourly?
If it makes sense, absolutely. If it makes sense. You know, contingency work in business transactions is very rare. It just is. Unless you're going after, you know, something that has deep, deep pockets and the counsel can collect, they rarely even offer it, right? That's why you see it mostly going in PI stuff with insurance companies defending, because they got deep pockets. If you get a judgment, they pay. So I don't see that very often, Jeff. And frankly, transactional work that I do hire outside counsel for, because I don't do every piece of transactional work, that is more likely a fixed fee product.
Now, for when you work as general counsel for companies that may need to contemplate future litigation. I'm thinking of like big companies. I'm not sure if you represent companies like, I'll give you for instance, in our last episode, we interviewed Kelly Earnby with the Orange County District Attorney's Office and with the Civil Enforcement Division enforcing unfair competition law against some pharmaceutical companies for price fixing. And she told us that she was a little surprised when the pharmaceutical company's attorneys made a motion to strike allegations in the pleading, which wound up taking the case all the way up to the Supreme Court, and where the Supreme Court held that, yes, the Orange County, any district attorney can file statewide litigation, and it really backfired on the big company's defense counsel. And I wondered if, gosh, this seems like maybe a line of defense was missing over there on their side of the table. And I wonder if that's kind of a layer of consideration that you might add, is thinking ahead, not just to winning this litigation, but even if you win this litigation, you could lose a war later on.
Yeah, that is a big deal. And when I said earlier about strategic planning, all of that has to come into effect. It works the opposite. I had a client that had higher collections legal bills than they had a default rate. Why? Because after about 5-6 years of going crazy, getting a bunch of judgments they'll never collect on, every lawyer out there in the public knew for a fact that if you stole or did not pay this client, They were coming after you. So there are reasons to do things like that. I'm not a big fan of that, to tell you the truth. Everything that I do that looks like, you know, scorched earth litigation, it's really only to bring people to the table. And believe me, I don't believe in taking the last dime off the table. I don't look at trying to bring people to their knees. That's not the issue. The issue is to get the resolution from my client, period. And if I have to do that by making the other side feel good, I'm going to do it by making them feel good.
What are some of the most common mistakes you see trial attorneys make?
Not knowing their client.
And what do you mean by that?
They have a litigation plan. They have their litigation plan. They know where they want to go with it. They know how they think they can argue it and go for it. If you don't know your client, that is a train wreck about to happen. You need to respond to the needs of your client as a litigator. My goodness gracious, litigators in my mind have to be the fastest thinking people on their feet around. All right. They have to learn all sorts of specialties that the different businesses that they represent do and how their businesses do it. Why they only have their way of going about things as opposed to satisfying the client's not only business need, but emotional needs, too. That's a big part of it. So I think that's the biggest deal when lawyers, not litigators only, but when lawyers get so full of themselves that they think that they have the only answers. Sit back, listen to your client. That is the biggest error that I see.
When you have a trial attorney that you keep coming back to, you have your client gives repeat business to a trial attorney. What's the most common factor that keeps your client coming back to that trial attorney? Is it just the inverse of that? The attorney knows what that client needs.
The thing that people keep coming back to is success. Understand something. Success is perception. Success is not a piece of paper. Success is not an end result. Success is an emotional feeling that you give to the client that they did the best they could in the situation that they had. All right. That's what keeps them coming back. I will tell you what makes them run away faster than anything. And it's a knock on all of us. And that is responsiveness and returning phone calls and emails. I'll tell you what I learned about 25 years ago, how important that was, or 30 years ago when the fax machine came in. My practice, when I first started out, it was easy to say, oh, you want this agreement? Great, I'll get it done, turn it around, get it into mail. You'll have it in 10 days, or 2 weeks, or a week. Then the fax machine came in with the thermal faxes that fade. You remember those? Then the faxes came in, and all of a sudden, your clients expected it now. They call you up for a 30-page agreement, and you get a phone call 2 hours later, where's my agreement?
Yeah,
that was a difficult change. Well, now let's add email to it. All right, that we all have. Let's add Zoom, where we could do documents on Zoom, looking at each other. This is a tough thing in terms of creating expectation. And what you have to do as a professional, if you don't want your client frustrated, is manage their expectations. Period.
Yeah,
that's half my job. I got to tell you something. Half my job is managing expectations of everyone around me. So, you know, that's kind of the way I look at it.
I want to come back to something you said about success and then tying that back into something you said earlier about a successful settlement is where no one is happy. So how do you square those two things? You know that you've gotten a great litigation outcome, but the client sometimes might think, unless you have managed those expectations, maybe that's the link early on to know that we're not going into this litigation to get a judgment that we can frame on the wall at the cost of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to trial counsel. We're doing it so that we can get an outcome. So maybe I've answered my own question, but
no, that's a really good thought. It is a reconciliation. Okay. Yes. Expectations have to be managed the entire way. So I'll just give you a really quick example about what I'm talking about. About more than a dozen years ago, I had a situation which was really bad, and a shop foreman in a steel fabrication company did some really, really bad things. Not bad intent, just stupid, right? And their new CFO that was brought into the company was embarrassed, and he left the company and sued. As when I was brought in, and after my explosive expletives at the shop foreman for being so stupid, my initial conversation with the client was how much they should expect to pay. And the client was frustrated. Well, wait, you're supposed to come in and tell me you're going to defend this and get this taken care of. And I said, yeah, I could blow smoke up your skirt. You want that? I'm happy to do that. But that's not the way it's going down. You're paying money. You're not insured. You didn't listen to me when I told you to get EPLI and coverage. All right. So you're paying. And so they came to me and asked me, well, how much do you think we're going to pay? I said, I hit a home run if I settle this for under $700. And they're in shock, of course. Right. But as you keep showing them what's going on and you show them other judgments and you see what that situation is, then they finally start coming around, and we actually settled that one for $400, and I was given a gift by the client for settling it for $400.
Yeah.
So it's about expectation. It's about letting them know what reality is and not trying to be the hero to solve and win everything.
You're constantly telling them what's up at the beginning and telling them, I told you so, at the end.
I try not to say the I told you so. You lose a lot of clients doing that.
Well, and tell us about, I mentioned your activity on LinkedIn, and you've got a great video series on LinkedIn about preparing a business for sale. I wonder if you tell us just a little bit about the genesis of that. You know, why did you think that attorneys and business owners needed to see that particular lesson? And that video series can be seen on Lee's website at callawyers.com, which is it's a great website. It's much better than mine, which I have to explain with Tango, Victor, Alpha. Way too complicated. Cal Lawyers, anyone can spell.
Oh, you're hilarious. Listen, like I said, anything that I have, social media or otherwise, is Gary Johnson and also Stephen Gregg. Stephen Gregg did my website, and he's done a great job. I do those video series because Gary pushes me to do those video series. That's number one. I've always took the position that I I'm a lawyer. I do law. I'm not a game show host. Okay. It just was very, very uncomfortable at first. And the way he got me to do it is by saying, listen, don't talk about you. Give value to people. Tell them something that they don't generally understand about. And this way you could feel good about what you're doing. You're not, putting your face on the side of the bus and say, yo soy abogado, So it started with that. And I've had some speaking engagements, several, regarding a few topics, preparing your business for sales, one of them. The other one is strategically planning and increasing your business value, which is the current one that I'm running. It's a 7-part series. And then I have one following up, which is a 6-part series right after that, is the attitude that business owners have to have if they're going to strategically plan their exit strategy for the best results. So between those are about a 20-21 part series. But honestly, I put that all together in an hour and a half presentation that I've done some keynote speaking on. So what I did was I thought I'd break that up and just give it to the general public on LinkedIn.
I think there's a lot of value in there. And I've got those bookmarked to share with my business clients when they need them. So I think it's a great service. And I got two more Gary Johnson plugs there. So I think I can probably wrangle free toppings on my buy one, get one at Baskin-Robbins out of them. So Lee, I want to thank you for joining us and sharing your experience as general counsel with us. I think it's hopefully will be a benefit to our audience of trial lawyers and appellate attorneys. And Jeff and I are going to talk about some legal news and tidbits. So Lee, stick around and you can kind of pipe in if you have any comments on our discussion of recent cases. So Jeff, why don't you take us into some of our news and tidbits for the week?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. And thank you, Lee, for being here today. And yeah, please pipe in if you have any thoughts on these stories. First off, I do want to share that the 4th Appellate District, Division 3 down in Orange County, has announced that Justice David Thompson is retiring effective October 15th. Oh. Justice Thompson, if you're listening, we'd love to have you as a guest on the podcast to discuss your 24 years on the bench. So congratulations on your retirement and come on the show.
Yeah, we'll have to get an invite out.
Go ahead, Tim.
Oh, you know, there's a case this week about Findleton versus Coyote Valley Band of Pomo Indians. And I had seen this one and I saw that you had mentioned it. You'd flagged it to talk about it as well, Jeff. So tell me what you saw out of it. And I have a couple of comments as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating too. You know, seasoned lawyers can look at a case and pull totally different issues out of it. I saw your write-up about it. Here's what caught my eye. The case is Findleton v. Coyote Valley Band of Pomo Indians out of the 1st District. It's published. And it involved a long-running construction and equipment rental dispute between an Indian tribe and a contractor. And the contractor repeatedly tried to enforce a mediation and an arbitration clause. And the tribe had tried every trick in the book, and many tricks that aren't in the book, to avoid arbitration and mediation, violated court orders, got sanctioned. And when the tribe attempted to appeal an award of sanctions, the contractor invoked the disentitlement doctrine. And the disentitlement doctrine says, look, when somebody is in violation of a court order, they can't go up to the court of appeal and seek relief. It's kind of like an unclean hands defense up at the appellate level. And that's what happened here. The contractor brought a motion to dismiss based on disentitlement, and the Court of Appeal granted the motion to dismiss the case. That's not unusual. What is unusual is what happened in this case is the Court of Appeal granted the motion and dismissed the appeal with this interesting twist. The appellant, the tribe, was free to petition the Court of Appeal to reinstate the appeal within 90 days if it showed proof of compliance with the lower court's orders. I've made and opposed these motions based on disentitlement. I've never seen a sort of dismissal like this before. And it seems to me in opposing these types of motions, it seemed to be a very good strategy to ask in the alternative to denial of the motion that the ability to seek reinstatement. And if you're making the motion to dismiss based on this doctrine, to explain the moving papers why allowing reinstatement or dismissing without prejudice would be itself prejudicial. But you pulled some other issues out of the case. What did you see, Tim?
Well, I did see that issue that you had that you just covered, Jeff. And I saw some other issues. It might be a little esoteric to ask even of our appellate podcast listeners. I put it in a write-up for those who wanted to try to absorb it in writing, but it had to do with the collateral order doctrine. But yeah, I agree with you that the disentitlement doctrine is a powerful remedy, but I just thought that the Court of Appeal here took a lot of the zip out of it by granting that motion to dismiss the appeal without prejudice and giving the and this wasn't a close call in terms of the disentitlement doctrine. That was the other thing that caught my eye is that there was just a laundry list. There's at least half a dozen violations that I saw that any one of which would have been sufficient to grant a motion on the disentitlement doctrine, and the court didn't seem to find it a close call, and yet granted the motion without prejudice.
Yeah, really surprising result there. A second thing that interests me about this decision is the commentary about the need for civility. You know, I'm always bringing to this show cases discussing civility. And this tribe, it was already in violation of several court orders, and it was facing dismissal under the disentitlement doctrine. And the tribe's lawyers made some personal attacks in the papers against the contractor's lawyers opposing the motion to dismiss. In response to these personal attacks, the court said, "We remind counsel and the parties that zealous advocacy does not equate with attack dog or scorched earth, nor does it mean lack of civility. Zeal and vigor in the representation of clients are commendable, but so are civility, courtesy, and cooperation, and they are not mutually exclusive."
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if the appellate lawyers on this case were the same lawyers who handled the matter at the trial level, because sometimes trial lawyers bring to an appeal a personal history and emotional investment in the case, and a fresh set of eyes and a cooler head from an appellate lawyer could be a benefit. Wonder what you thought about that.
I'd love to add on that. I will tell you that right now, I will never have my trial lawyers handle my appeals ever. Ever. Yeah. As a matter of fact, after seeing all your podcasts and Tim, frankly, reading all the complexities of your posts, I would absolutely, if I have to go to trial, I am telling you, an appellate lawyer is sitting at that trial table throughout the entire trial. You can't do it any other way, not responsibly.
Jeff, make sure Lee's check clears.
Yeah, music to my ears. You know, and look, sometimes trial lawyers bring to an appeal this history, this personal animosity. You know, no trial lawyer, I think, intentionally makes personal attacks on opposing counsel when they're making these statements in a brief. They think it's relevant. And an outside appellate attorney can bring some fresh eyes and perhaps a cooler head and help that trial lawyer not step in it. So, yeah, it was interesting.
Back in episode 3, we discussed some appellate strategies on summary judgment motions. And I think back then I had suggested the tip that when opposing a summary judgment motion, you should always consider raising the issue that there is more discovery that you need in order to oppose that summary judgment motion. And because if the court denies you that relief, that could give you an additional ground to challenge a summary judgment on appeal should you lose the motion. And I have to amend that advice now after reading the case Begley versus Delta Dental of California. The plaintiff there had asked for more discovery, but did not use the magic words by identifying that particular essential facts may exist. The plaintiff didn't include those words in her affidavit, so discovery was denied. Summary judgment was granted, and the summary judgment was affirmed on appeal. I have a critical comment about the Begley case, and that is that I thought the requirement that the opposing party has to identify particular facts that may exist, it's not in the statute. It's not in 437C subdivision H, which authorizes the opposing party to seek more time to conduct discovery in order to oppose the motion. And I thought that imposing this non-statutory requirement on the opposing party means that in the event a moving party moves early for a summary judgment before the opposing party has had time to conduct complete discovery for their case and their defense, the opposing party's right to discovery now can be subject essentially to what amounts to a good cause requirement. Basically, to get the discovery extension provided under 437C sub H, you have to already know what you're going to find. So I thought, how does this square with California's otherwise liberal right to discovery?
It doesn't. It doesn't square with it. You know, the statute uses the mandatory word shall in terms of a continuance. And Begley seems to infuse the trial court with quite a bit of discretion in terms of finding good cause. The mandatory portion of the statute, the statutory right to continuance, is only as strong as the judge's willingness to allow for discovery and allow for a delay of the motion. I'm glad this case is not published.
I am too, although it cites published authority on it. So this is the law in California. I think the upshot is that do not delay in conducting your discovery. As soon as you can start conducting discovery on your defenses and claims in the case, do so. And then if you haven't finished by the time the other party files a summary judgment motion, finish your discovery, get it on. And because you're not going to be able to get that discovery continuance, you don't necessarily have a right to it, even though the statute says you do, unless you essentially know the facts that are out there in discovery that's still yet undone.
And be sure to use the magic words in your request for a continuance. All right. Well,
you got the last word.
Almost. That wraps up this episode.
If you have suggestions for future episodes, please email us at calpodcast@gmail.com. That's calpodcast@gmail.com. And our upcoming episodes, look for more tips on how to lay the groundwork for an appeal when preparing for trial.
See you next time.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Lee.
I love getting the last word in. Thanks, Tim.
You have just listened to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. For more information about the cases discussed in today's episode, our hosts, and other episodes, visit the California Appellate Law Podcast website at calpodcast.com. That's calpodcast.com. Thanks to Jonathan Caro for our intro music. Thank you for listening, and please join us again